Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Producer Owen Sweeney, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brendan O'Connor.
Now look, Owen, I think you and I need to apologise to people, set the record straight. Back in 2021, we may have looked back 50 years and said that 1971 was the most important year in rock. And indeed, last year, we may have looked back and said 1972 was the most important year in rock. Here we are in 2023, and we've discovered that actually 1973 was a seminal year in music. So so we go back. What was going on in music 50 years ago? So give me the big picture. Where were we at?
Well, I suppose we did look at 71 was kind of the high watermark, blah, 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 the Stones. You know, everyone's released some really good albums, and that's great. And, you know, the dawn of the singer-songwriter and all these great things, and you know, kind of the gender balance was good, and everything was kind of, you know, everything that had happened in the 60s had come to fruition. 72, okay. We surprised ourselves, as you say, you know, it was another good year. But 73, to me now, if I was to big picture it, Brendan, as you asked me there at the outset, this is the 70s now. The 60s are gone. Okay. That's kind of a cut-off point.
Right.
As far as I can say, we're starting again here. We're moving forward. There's a great sense of kind of, you know, and also politics have kind of gone by the wayside, because the politics was a big thing in 71 and 72. The Vietnam War effectively ends in January 1973. So Marvin Gaye, of course, and we'll get to him in a minute, I'm sure, who had released, you know, the seminal What's Going On in 1971, was releasing a somewhat more date night based Let's Get It On in 1973.
Okay, let's take a little bit of Marvin Gaye. So okay, so this is a completely different point. So he's been out at the protest, but now he's come home and his lady is there.
Exactly. Okay. Right. He's coming home, and it is very much kind of the feel of American music, and particularly what soul was. We talked again about, you know, how Motown had kind of been, and this is interesting as well, because Motown was very much Berry Gordy trying to market great pop music for a mass American and then worldwide audience. And then he had to hold on to the likes of Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder, and he did, and they were releasing kind of, you know, huge kind of more intricate and more elaborate kind of albums.
So they basically, we've talked about this before.
We have.
They grew up,
but
they said Motown needs to grow up.
Needs to grow up, and then a lot of artists would leave Motown because obviously they weren't getting the money that Berry Gordy was keeping for himself, shall we say. And, you know, he wasn't one for sharing out the wealth. But, you know, I suppose that the African-American audience now was less political. James Brown is another example. James Brown, you know, Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud in 1968, 69, 70, 71, all those great kind of the Black Panther movement and all that sort of stuff, is now kind of blaxploitation films are being made. There's almost its own market again. Do you know, the kind of the African-American market?
Okay, and it's just about entertainment.
It's about entertainment, you know, and, you know, it's about kind of, you know, kind of something for the smoochy romantic evenings. Yes, it's also about, you know, kind of those great movies like Black Caesar and kind of, well, maybe not great movies, but seminal kind of the time movies, you know, Hell Up in Harlem, which he did the Payback. It's records. They're not pandering to a wider audience. There's kind of a self-assuredness, kind of a, you know, I don't want to say insularity is kind of a negative term, but, you know, kind of, you know, a self-contained kind of, you know, this will do. This is what we want to do. And funk happens as well. So okay, music so had gotten
this
harder.
This is when funk is kicking in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cosmic Slop by Funkadelic comes out. That's a great record this year, but it's not pandering to a wider kind of FM audience, if you like,
okay,
of white middle
white
America.
And are white people listening to this music, or is it its own market now?
Do you know what? When you look at, say, the 1980s, right, Prince, and it happened to Whitney Houston and everything else, you know, kind of Prince did his rock stuff, and then kind of he went back, because, of course, you're getting criticism from within your own community that you're, you know, you're pandering to white America.
Okay.
It's all very politicized, isn't it? And unspoken about until it's very much spoken about. And Prince, what did Prince do? He went back to funk. So this is kind of, you know, we're fine. We're making music for ourselves here.
Okay.
You know, you come to us, we're not coming to you.
And then there's easy listening kind of becoming a big thing that
exactly,
year.
Exactly,
well,
yeah. There's a great, I suppose, you know, Grammy Awards only get mentioned when someone passes on. by and large in their obituaries, and they don't often mean a lot to, I suppose, the likes of you and me. But in the case of, I want to mention one, Roberta Flack. Roberta Flack in 1970 won the Grammy Award for Record of the Year in 1973 with a song called Killing Me Softly, with his song to give it its full title.
Yeah.
And her story is fascinating because you might, or you covered it yourself on the show last year. Do you remember when Kate Bush turned up in Stranger Things, and it was kind of, you know, the placement and the reigniting of someone's career and people looking at their work. Roberta Flack had released her debut album in 1969 and had gone back to basically teaching music. She was a wonderful piano player, wonderful arranger and great singer, obviously, as well, and great interpreter of people's songs. So she was kind of releasing small time records which weren't doing anything great until Clint Eastwood was making his debut movie, Play Misty for Me.
Okay.
He needed a song for his own smoochy, stalkerish, but smoochy scene, which he played the entire record in it. And he found Roberta Flack doing First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. So 3 years later, she becomes a megastar.
Okay.
And then the year after, and she wins Grammy of the Year for that record. And then a year after, she wins Grammy of the Year, or Grammy for Record of the Year, the year after for Killing Me Softly with his song.
Okay, let's have a little bit of that. I'm in my bed with his finger, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song.
And of course people know the Fugees version of this, but you hear this with its original kind of 70s kind of vibe.
It's lush.
Lush is the word, isn't it?
Isn't it? As I say, like a wonderful piano player and a former teacher.
She
did all these arrangements herself. And this is soul music
informing a kind of the mainstream.
Exactly, exactly. And this was huge. You couldn't escape this in 1973. And of course, you know, if you grew up in the ages of the 90s and you heard the Fugees version, it might have come at you fresh.
Yeah.
And there's another artist, again, kind of in the 90s sense, Maria Muldaur. Her debut album comes out, and that features Midnight at the Oasis. So as I'm listening to her, I listen to 40
albums.
Okay,
Midnight
40
at the
albums,
Oasis, which I would associate with the Brand New Heavies.
Exactly.
Around the time of acid jazz. So that's actually an old 70s.
Is that 1973, that song comes out, and her debut album, which is kind of rootsy, kind of Appalachian. In fact, she's a Dolly Parton song on that, My Tennessee Mountain Home, which Dolly Parton herself only released in 1973. And in the middle of that is Midnight at the Oasis, which is just, you know, acid jazz. You summed it up. Like, nothing could be more 90s to my mind than that song, you know.
Yeah.
That isn't Britpop, God help us. But and you ally that to the Fugees. So there's great kind of 1973 stuff. As I say, kind of the 60s are gone now. We're into a whole new era here. And American music has given us something a bit more funky, yes, overtly funky, but also kind of this lush, easy listening, again, is an adequate term, but it has a bit more depth to it, doesn't
it? Okay, you're great at that. I love the tracing of these kind of the moods of what's coming through. So what was going on in Ireland at that stage?
It was a great year for Ireland, actually, for Irish rock in particular. And for Irish music, I suppose, and fusing. Oh, there's that terrible word. I thought I wasn't going to say it.
Yeah.
Fusing traditional Irish music and prog, shall we say, in some cases, hard rock in other cases, and the blues in the case of, obviously, Rory Gallagher. I'm going to nod to Cork. It's the only mention of Cork we'll mention, because
okay,
I think he used
your
weekend's quota yesterday.
Weekend, yeah.
But The Thawing is released by Horselips. Now, nothing could be more Irish.
Was that their
Irish.
First album?
It was their second album.
Album.
But it is the one with Jarrod Doom on it.
Yeah.
And without that, we wouldn't have put him under pressure. How would Italian 90 sound without that? It wouldn't. This is Irish folklore, it's Irish legend. It is prog. The second track is Charolais. It's about a cow, basically, you know, and Pink Floyd only put them on the cover of their albums. Horselips wrote songs about them. This is the birth of Celtic rock. It's phenomenal.
So
and it's
the
a
tail
great
end
record,
of
like.
The kind of ballad folk revival is starting to feed into the rock and roll crowd.
Well, because you have Planxty at the same time. Planxty released their first album the previous year, but The Well Below the Valley comes out this year, and there's a great droning quality to it as well. So Hello Lancome, you know, that's going on.
Okay.
Christie's in there as well. Andy Irvine and Donal Lunny and all these people. And Rory, as I say, Rory Gallagher releases two albums this year, Blueprint and Tattoo, which, you know, featuring Tattoo Lady and, you know, that great track and just great blues, you know, and kind of Power Trio and all that. And Van releases Hard Knows the Highway. And Lizzie, Thin Lizzy, excuse me, to get her full name, released Vagabonds of the Western World, featuring art by Jim Fitzpatrick. So art is important.
And was that when Thin Lizzy are kind of breaking through as well?
Lizzie broke through that year. 72, 73. It's always a bit awkward to kind of cut off things because singles released in 1972, like Whiskey in the Jar, become hits in 1972 or 73, depending on when they're released in different parts of the world. That wasn't on any album, but Vagabonds is the album that comes out after Whiskey in the Jar is a massive hit.
So that's the last album is a three piece. A proper rock scene in Ireland, then, is it in a way?
Our stories are now being put onto record, do you know? And our bands are now making waves. Rory Gallagher, Johnny Marr turned up at Glastonbury yesterday. His ultimate hero in guitar was Rory Gallagher.
Really?
He has one of Rory Gallagher's guitars. And so he's an absolute legend. And, you know, because of the way the selection process of history and because of, you know, the commercial prospects of some of this music and whether it's kind of, you know, turns up in ads or whatever the vagaries of popular culture are, some people, they don't entirely get written out of history, but their story gets diminished or lessened in importance. But Rory Gallagher, his importance to Irish music shouldn't be overstated or understated. And likewise, Horselips, do you know? It's a fantastic record, The Thawing. And they go on, and they, you know, the rest of the decade. But they create a scene in Ireland, most importantly.
David Bowie is kind of getting into his stride now in his decade of creativity, I suppose we'd call it. So he did two albums in 73.
Yes, two albums. And very interesting. As I said, we cut off the 60s. The second of those albums is Pin-Ups, but that's Bowie doing kind of his influences, you know, and kind of he's looking back at the 60s now. So the 60s are in the past. This is what created David Bowie.
Right.
Most importantly, and it's where a lot of people would have heard songs like See Emily Play by Pink Floyd, you know, kind of, you know, and Friday on My Mind with Easy Beats. They're all on there. But that's the lesser two. That's more contractual kind of obligation filler. In 1973, Bowie kills off Ziggy Stardust, and live on stage in London at the last night of the tour, captured on film famously. So Ziggy is now dead and Bowie's moving on, ostensibly because he sees the writing on the wall for, you know, the glam scene and his glam persona. So he releases Aladdin Sane. Now, the interesting thing about all this, and you're talking about his decade of creativity, this is Bowie. This is, if you ask someone to draw David Bowie or to draw something that signifies David Bowie, it would be the cover of this album.
The lightning stripe.
The lightning stripe across the face, exactly. The great thing is, on the cover of Ziggy Stardust, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars from 1972, he doesn't look like Ziggy Stardust, of course, because he's just got kind of short hair. On the cover of Aladdin Sane, now he's killed off Ziggy Stardust, he looks like Ziggy Stardust, and he also looks like him on the next album as well.
It was all bleeding into everything. He was changing at a rate of knots, and then by the time the albums were out, he'd moved on.
Exactly right. Yeah. That definitely happened. Of course, he was desperate to be famous, and now he absolutely had both hands on fame and longevity. He wasn't going to let go. Interestingly, T-Rex released Tanks this year, and I had never listened to this album. 40 albums I've listened to this week from 1973 that I wasn't familiar. I know, the homework is done. Yeah. But that's aside from the ones I had did know and had heard. But that album, you know, because T-Rex's story goes, poor old Mark Bolan, he was stuck in, you know, kind of glam
teeny bopper
world, and, you know, and he couldn't get out of it, and it destroyed him in the end. And Bowie, of course, was the man, and kind of, you know, he saw the writing on the wall, as you say, and moved on. But T-Rex's album that year has got great soulful African-American backing singers on it. He's getting away from the glam, and although Born to Boogie's on it, he's getting away from the guitar kind of swaggery glam rock, going into more soulful stuff, which of course Bowie would do two albums later on Young Americans.
So
no one's paying attention to Mark
Bolan. So worth a look, actually.
He was evolving, and of course Bowie was still kind of in his slipstream perhaps, but, you know, the history is written by the winners, Brendan.
Bowie was a better salesman in the end.
100%.
Prog rock, we can't ignore it. Prog rock was kind of getting into its stride as well, wasn't it?
It's amazing. I mean, the biggest album of 1973 is, of course, Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, okay, yeah. You know, the biggest album of all time,
Maybe I've gone there too quickly, but Floyd are seen as a prog band, so why not? But it is. It's Yes are releasing Tales of Topographic Oceans, which is a triple album. I did, Brendan, for the second time in my life, I listened to it this week, and I'm still none the wiser. I'm fascinated by prog rock because I just don't get it. King Crimson.
Were people very stoned listening to it? Is that part of it?
A triple album with four songs on it, I think that's part of the attraction, very definitely. King Crimson did, it was very English as well. Lark's Tongues in Aspic by King Crimson came out this year.
So kind of folky
psychedelic-y.
Some of it's very kind of woodlands. Pastoral. Exactly. Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah. And okay. Floyd definitely kind of fit in there. But Floyd, the band that should never have survived. You know, when Syd Barrett went his merry way and the management went with them, because, of course, he wrote all the songs.
Yeah.
They were lumbering around doing, you know, Be Careful With That Axe, Eugene, and all these songs from 1968, Putting Cows, they say, on the cover of an album called Atom Heart Mother, which got to number one, but no one can tell me why. Yeah. Had they not got a deal with EMI where they basically had unlimited studio time, they would have absolutely disintegrated. However, for whatever reason, out of pigheadedness or just sheer kind of, you know, upper English middle class kind of self-assuredness, they kept going, and eventually they hit upon the absolute motherlode, an album that was in the British charts for 15 years, 741 weeks. Dark Side of the Moon, which, as you say, is one of the biggest albums of all time.
But I suppose every generation goes through a dope-smoking phase. So there's each generation that comes along discovers it afresh, yeah.
Isn't it that great story? If you listen to the third roar at the start of the MGM line before Wizard of Oz, it absolutely syncs up, which I think we've all probably done very late at night.
I've never done that. Okay. Elton John was kind of going stratospheric at this point, was he?
100%. The second and third of his six US number one albums in a row happened this year. Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player, and the double album that is Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And he will be saying goodbye to the Yellow Brick Road tonight at Glastonbury, I believe. That's his last his last show ever. Interestingly, three members of his band, unless they're not there tonight, but they're certainly members of his current touring band, are on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road and Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player, which is fascinating. For all his tantrums and tiaras.
Yeah, he's obviously a good employer. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, let's have a little bit of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. The guy who worked with him for a long time, who wrote a book, it was in a few months ago, but he was saying that, I think Elton was in LA at this point, had decamped to LA, this wasn't out yet, and everyone who he met and everyone who called up to the house, he was playing this for them, and he was saying, like, this is it, and everybody's minds were blown by it, apparently. But it is, probably his high point, I would say.
You know, it is, the BBC, they don't do it themselves, they farm it out, but the classic album series, the only one they would have done, I believe, on Elton John is this album. This is kind of the high water mark for his career. It's a double album. It couldn't be more 70s. Again, people like Elton John are very 70s. They had been kind of, you know, faffing around in the 60s, Bowie the same.
But
they're 70s artists. Yeah. You know, it's very much now. It's a double album. It's mature. The charts were kind of for the kids. The older siblings, brothers and sisters, were listening to Elton John double albums.
Yeah.
They're not
there. And they're starting to make money too.
They're
starting to make
the big money,
aren't they?
And they're making money in America as well. And we didn't mention, I should have mentioned, Gilbert O'Sullivan, of course. You know, Ireland's Gilbert O'Sullivan from Waterford. Massive hit singles in 72 in Ireland and America, and also followed up with I'm a Writer, Not a Fighter, and Get Down in 1973. It was a huge hit in America as well as England. So, you know.
Okay. So he was actually pure Irish, born and bred.
Okay.
Listen, going back to Prague for a minute, there was a lot of crossover.
There's a phrase
again.
I never thought I'd hear you
let's
say.
Let's have a listen to the theme tune from The Exorcist which was an important moment in music. Have we got it? And again, like,
sends a chill.
I'm saying, guy who's too stoned noodling on a piano, right? But he definitely hit on a kind of a cultural moment there with that, didn't he?
He did, and he's not the only one. His employer, or at least his record label boss, this was the first album released on a label called
Mike Oldfield, we should say.
That's Mike Oldfield, yes. His sister Sally was born in Dublin, funny enough, and she appears in backing vocals on this album. He's from Reading. But yeah, his label boss on Virgin Records, this is the first LP released on the Virgin label, and Richard Branson's career was made here just as much. I'm sure he would have gone on to good things anyway. He had the shops, but he'd started the record label, and he went with, well, what would you call it? Tubular Bells Part 1 and Tubular Bells Part 2, just the two tracks, Brendan on either side of the LP. Mike Oldfield was 19 at the time, played almost every instrument. It does go on. It doesn't all sound like that. William Friedkin, the film director, of course, legend has it, needed something for The Exorcist, his film, and put this those opening bits onto the soundtrack of the film, and lo and behold, a legend was made in the form, and a lot of money by Mike Oldfield and Richard Branson.
Owen, our time is up.
Oh, no.
But into the break, we play a bit of this. The song of the year, you're saying, Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Does it get any better? You don't even need the music on this. Gladys Knight and the Pips, Midnight Train to Georgia. This is one of my, this is possibly my favourite record from
Owen Sweeney, thanks a million. We'll see you in 2024, if not before.